My presentation this afternoon is in two parts, both quite short. The first one will sound more like an academic presentation, and the second one will probably sound more like a short story, and I'll pause in between. The title of the first piece is Say Who I Am, or A Broad Private Wink. And I'm going to begin my text with a quote from a novel called Friday by Michel Tournier. Nearly a year had passed before he perceived that his love was bringing about a change in the vegetation of the Pink Coombe. He had taken no notice at first of the disappearance of grasses and small seedlings from the places where his own seed was sown. But his attention was caught by the growth of a new plant that he'd seen nowhere else on the island. The plant had large, lace-edged leaves which grew in clusters at the level of the earth on a very short stalk. It bore white, sharp-scented blossoms with pointed petals and brown, ample berries which largely overflowed their calyxes. Robinson observed them with curiosity, but thought no more about them until the day when it became unmistakably apparent that they'd appeared within a few weeks at the precise place where he had sown his seed. Reimagining the art object, sharing some basic ontological qualities with the riddle, I'd like to discuss some ways to write around the art object, to elicit, to unlock, to induce its essential obscurity with essential obscurity. Approaching the writing of this presentation, I looked back at my original proposal, and you can see it in the little supplement, and discovered that I'd used a very wrong word. In fact, the usage of this wrong word was somewhat of a fundamental error on my part. And thankfully, now that I've amended this, I can proceed, or can I? My wrong word was deduce. What I really should have said was induce. For to loiter near the art object with an intention of critiquing it should essentially be a procedure of induction rather than of deduction, in that we are working marginally in order to return closer to the artwork rather than inferring or tracing logical conclusion from the clues given. We should keep in mind that, after all, the supposed deducer Sherlock Holmes had but detailed knowledge of everything that could be applied to his inductive investigations of crime, but little to no knowledge of the material world outside of his investigations, i.e. whatever wasn't relevant. We can see this inductive approach, the approach of the conscientious critic, perhaps. In a quote from Sherlock Holmes here from Conan Doyle's 1887 novel, A Study in Scarlet, and I quote, "Most people, if you describe a train of events to them, will tell you what the result would be. They can put those events together in their minds and argue from them that something will come to pass. There are few people, however, who, if told a result, would be able to evolve from their own inner consciousness what the steps were that led up to that result. Yeah. This power is what I mean when I talk of reasoning backward. This backwards induction is temporal in nature, linked as it is to causality, that is to say, quotation cause and effect. This experiential relationship to time is central to looking at and making sense of almost anything. And here I'm considering time as a metalliptic space that close looking takes place within, both in terms of the actual personal time in spent looking or reading and the historical timeline or cultural lineage within which a work is placed, suggesting a temporal compression of time through looking as a close activity in itself. So it's this idea of reading and writing the object simultaneously. All of this, of course, has direct implications, not only for the validity of the judgment procedures of art criticism, but also for its direction, speed, and methods of approach. So let's reconsider Sherlock Holmes's impulse of reasoning backward in relation to an observation, again from Michel Tournier, but from his autobiography, The Wind Spirit. I don't know if anybody's ever read it, but it's an absolute scream. He used to share a flat with Deleuze. So the autobiography is halfway between thinking Deleuze is absolutely brilliant, and he says about himself when they were studying that while they were all firing tennis balls, Deleuze was firing cannonballs. But at the same time, he keeps saying how shit Deleuze is and how he is much better, but his work is too complex to be understood. And Deleuze's is very simple. So it is a bit of a scream. Anyway, I digress. So this quote is from his autobiography, The Wind Spirit. And it's, in my view, an observation in which we may catch strains of the faint scent of critical methodology. In all good philosophy, the solution always precedes the problem. The problem is nothing but the shadow cast by its solution, a fountain of clarity that spurts motu proprio here meaning of its own accord, into the empyrean of the intelligible. Now, whilst I would not necessarily hold with or particularly desire the type of clarity that is generally assumed to be of use to culturally assemble, or maybe that is reassemble, a complete art object, rendering it less leaky and therefore more substantive or marketable from any viewable angle, I'd like to suggest we spend some time reimagining how this backwards movement might help us to assess the art object more clearly. That is, to further the purposes of powerless, here meaning difficult or uncertain, rather than its homophone, powerless, investigation. But then again, there's backwards movement and backwards movement. As we all nearly know by now, Cartesian analysis suggests that when given a problem to be solved, we examine the conditions to be fulfilled, dividing them into simpler conditions that are themselves easier to solve. In Descartes' words, divide each of the difficulties I was examining into as many parts as possible and as is required to solve them best. To go backwards, to go backwards, to speak from the given problem to the simpler and solvable constituent parts. This type of backwards movement presents a problem, however, in art writing, in terms of how to divide, to sort, or again to order the parts into a form that seems easier to inspect. This ordering action, by its very nature, suggests a sequential or narrative thrust towards a specific destination, perhaps a place of judgment. Not, I would suggest, a very useful movement in criticism, and one that's often characterised by descriptive rather than inscriptive processes. The kind of backward movement that interests us here is more closely identified with the seemingly counterintuitive dynamism of Blanchot's Orphic gaze, its power to inspect, to vaporise, to transform. Blanchot has written in his essay, The Gaze of Orpheus, at first sight, the image does not resemble a cadaver, but it could be that the strangeness of the cadaver is also the strangeness of the image. What is left behind is precisely this cadaver, which is not of the world either. Even though it is here, which is rather behind the world, which now affirms on the basis of this the possibility of a world behind a return to backwards. That's end of quote. This return to backwards depicts a resistance, or perhaps more exactly a sly challenge to comprehension, highlighting as it does the essential obscurity of the image, or here as we are terming it, the art object, thereby suggesting that it must be approached in a different way. And just as the cadaver itself is in a state of infinite erosion, so too is the art object, in terms of its physical presence, together with its cultural and economic currencies. Contemporary art criticism that is nurtured by the appearance of value may be observed to be assembling an inauthentic, absolute, or teratological corpus monster, through rationalistic grafting of interpretation from lots of scrappy parts. Criticism demanding to be read of itself while simultaneously calling for a rereading of something which is outside of itself. And I've just got a little riddle here which is taken from a really fantastic book called A Feast of Creatures, Anglo-Saxon Riddle Songs. I sing round the truth, if I may, in a ringing riddle. I've got quite a long quote here. I'll try and whip through it quite quickly from Umberto Eco and On Literature, but there's something quite important in it. And I quote, "Let us try to approach a narrative work with common sense and compare the assumptions we can make about it with those we can make about the world. As far as the world is concerned, we find that the laws of universal gravitation are those established by Newton. And yet, if we keep an open mind, we will always be prepared to revise our convictions the day science formulates the great laws of the cosmos differently. On the other hand, as far as the world of books is concerned, propositions like Little Red Riding Hood is eaten by the wolf and then freed by the woodcutter, or Anna Karenina commits suicide, will remain true for eternity, and no one will ever be able to refute them. There is little respect for those who claim that Superman is not Clark Kent. Literary texts explicitly provide us with much that we will never cast doubt upon, but also, unlike the real world, they flag with supreme authority what we are to take as important in them." That's the end of that quote. Eco's observations here about the irrefutable veracity of fiction are a useful counterpoint to the stud wall of overdetermination. Do you say stud wall here? Great. Pointing as they do to the ways of fiction as a fixative of meaning. We can look to less orthodox modes, perhaps, of criticism to examine the dissolution or again dissemination of this absolute object, in the same way as we look to fiction to lead us on an aporetic procedure, enacting critical judgments through question after question rather than answer after answer. Criticism can coax objects to speak, but we must be prepared to accept that these very same objects may only be able to answer us in riddles, and furthermore, that we must be prepared to approach them in riddlic form in order to elicit perhaps the most sophisticated or productive responses. This formal correspondence between the riddlic form, the art object, and the writing with the art object bears witness to the implications of the word riddle, which is etymologically linked to the verb to read. This complex object, this art object, this riddle creature, may, by speaking, shed itself of this transient freight of deductive judgment value, encouraging us to develop the catoptric approach of being reader and writer at the same time, or again to write as we read the object critically. Monsieur Tess, Paul Valéry's eponymous anti-hero, asserted that God made everything out of nothing, but the nothing shows through. Perhaps it's this very nothing of the art object which may be interrogated and indeed celebrated as a half-intended discovery through the backward reasoning of more experimental modalities of criticism. But only if that very same criticism is willing to embrace and, yes, maybe even embody the inherent obscurity, the delicacy, the dispersive excursion of induction. That's the end of the first text.